Thomas Hutchinson escaped with a couple of minutes to spare. The Lieutenant Governor of Massachusetts was dining in his three-story Boston mansion when a breathless messenger announced that the mob was surging down the street. Hutchinson and his family fled through the garden just before, in his words,
"The hellish crew fell upon my house with the rage of devils, and in a moment split down the door and entered. Not contented with tearing off all the wainscot and hangings and splitting the doors to pieces, they beat down the partition walls and began to take the slate and boards from the roof and were prevented only by the approaching daylight from a total demolition of the building. Besides my plate and my family's pictures, household furniture of every kind, and my own children and servants' apparel, they carried off about £900 sterling in money and emptied the house of everything whatsoever, except a part of the kitchen furniture, not leaving a single book or paper in it."
This was August 1765, only a couple of years since the triumphant end of the Seven Years' War, when the British had gobbled up French America. Bostonians had raised statues in gratitude to King George III and to William Pitt, the architect of victory. Yet now the British government and its representatives were targets of some of the most frightening mob violence seen in the American colonies. So why this sea change in public mood? Well, after the victory came the reckoning. The war had doubled Britain's national debt and increased fivefold the cost of defending and running North America. The British government was determined to make the colonials pay their share, and most members of Parliament agreed. One stated bluntly,
"The word colony implies subordination. If America looks to Great Britain for protection, she must enable us to protect her. If she expects our fleets, she must assist our revenue. Will these Americans, children planted by our care and protected by our arms, will they grudge to contribute their might to relieve us from the heavy weight of that burden which we lie under?"
In March 1765, the British Parliament approved a law extending stamp duty to the colonies. There was little dissent in London, but across the Atlantic, the Stamp Act caused an explosion. This was the first direct tax, as distinct from duties on trade, which Britain had demanded from the colonies. What's more, it was imposed during an economic recession, and it intruded into every crevice of daily life, because a special paper embossed with a revenue stamp had to be purchased for all sorts of documents, from mortgages to newspapers. So stamp duty hit hardest on the business and chattering classes, merchants, lawyers and editors, who were well able to shout out and hit back. That's why, in August 1765, their leaders roused the city mobs, plied them with drink, and pointed them at agents of the British government like Hutchinson. The violence in Boston spread rapidly. Groups calling themselves Sons of Liberty were organised in various cities, and merchants boycotted imports from Britain. In October 1765, representatives of most of the 13 colonies met in New York to petition the King to repeal the Stamp Act. The Stamp Act Congress, as the gathering was called, agreed a declaration of right that would shape all future debate.
"That it is inseparably essential to the freedom of a people and the undoubted right of Englishmen that no taxes be imposed on them but with their own consent, given personally or by their representatives. That the people of these colonies are not, and from their local circumstances cannot be, represented in the House of Commons in Great Britain."
Here was the colonists' basic principle: no taxation without representation. But for the moment, the immediate crisis was diffused. A new government in London repealed the Stamp Act, and the protests in America died down. Yet Parliament passed another act declaring that it had full authority to make laws over the American colonies. So the underlying issue became clear. Britain wanted more revenue from America and claimed the right to extract it. The colonists argued that taxes could be raised only with the consent of their own legislatures. In June 1767, Charles Townshend, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, tried again by imposing higher duties on items such as glass, paper and tea imported into the colonies. He claimed that although the colonial assemblies could decide their own direct taxes, the British Parliament had authority over external taxes such as customs. But the Townshend duties revived the resistance movement, local committees and economic boycotts backed up by renter mobs. Once again, Boston was the hot spot, and the British government took the unprecedented step of garrisoning troops there to keep order. On October 1, 1768, two regiments of British redcoats landed at Boston's Long Wharf. Fully armed and in dress uniform, they marched through the town with drums beating, fife playing and colours flying. Red-coated soldiers, yellow-jacketed drummers and huge grenadiers in their bearskin caps. The citizens watched in cowed, sullen silence. But once the troops were quartered in tents on Boston Common or in warehouses around the port, friction soon developed. The locals jeered at the soldiers, throwing snowballs, stones, even dung, and angry redcoats got into brawls. One of them, the worst for drink, shouted at some black slaves,
"Go home and cut your master's throats. Come to me, and I will make you free. And if any person opposeth you, I will run my sword through their hearts."
This was inflammatory stuff, and he was brought before a magistrate. As with any army of occupation, it was only a matter of time before an explosion occurred. On the evening of March the 5th, 1770, with snow packed hard on the streets, a lone British soldier was doing sentry duty at the custom house. Taunted by some young apprentices, he hit one of them with the butt of his musket. The others retaliated with blocks of ice as a crowd gathered.
"Lousy rascal!
Lobster! Kill him! Knock him down!
Fire, damn you! Fire!
Go home!"
Hearing the clamour, Captain Thomas Preston took a corporal and six men to rescue the soldier. They too were cornered by the crowd, now several hundred strong. One of the redcoats, knocked to the ground by a missile, fired his musket. More shots followed, despite Captain Preston's efforts at restraint. Five Bostonians died. One of them, called Crispus Attucks, of mixed African and Indian descent, was later adopted as a black American hero. Like many street fights, the precise story is hard to establish. Captain Preston was later tried and acquitted. But as so often, the image mattered more than the reality. Engraver Paul Revere, a patriot with one eye also on profit, turned out a print of the bloody massacre that became a bestseller. This showed a line of redcoats firing a volley into defenceless citizens at the order of sword-waving Preston. Once again, a change of government in London enabled Britain to back off. Lord North, the new Prime Minister, had the Townshend duties repealed and withdrew the troops, but he kept the duty on tea in order to affirm the supremacy of the British Parliament over the colonies. Here were the seeds of the next crisis. In 1773, the British East India Company, a major trading corporation that effectively ran India, was given the monopoly for selling tea in North America. The government's main aim was to save the struggling company from bankruptcy, but it was also trying to control the rampant smuggling along the American coast. Again, British interests collided with those of the colonies. The local American networks of resistance swung into action once more, with Boston, as usual, taking the lead. The hated Thomas Hutchinson, whose house had been sacked a few years earlier, was now governor of Massachusetts, and two of his sons were the sales agents for the East India Company. All this fueled discontent. When Hutchinson insisted in December 1773 that tea ships should land their cargo in Boston, a group of 60 self-styled patriots took matters into their own hands. One of them, George Hughes, a Boston shoemaker, recalled what happened.
"It was now evening, and I dressed myself in the costume of an Indian, equipped with a small hatchet and a club. After having painted my face and hands with coal dust in the shop of a blacksmith, I fell in with many who were dressed, equipped, and painted as I was. When we arrived at the wharf, we then were ordered by our commander to open the hatches and take out all the chests of tea and throw them overboard. And we immediately proceeded to execute his orders, first cutting and splitting the chests with our tomahawks so as thoroughly to expose them to the effects of the water. In about 3 hours from the time we went on board, we had thus broken and thrown overboard every tea chest to be found in the ship. While those in the other ships were disposing of the tea in the same way at the same time.
In those 3 hours, the contents of 340 chests of tea worth £10,000 had been dumped in the water. One of the leaders of the Boston Tea Party was Paul Revere, the engraver who'd immortalized the Boston Massacre. Afterwards, he saddled up and took the news to New York, from where it was sent on southwards, spawning new tea parties in its wake. The news took a month to reach London. King George III wrote,
"I am much hurt that the instigation of bad men hath again drawn the people of Boston to take such unjustifiable steps."
This was the general view in Whitehall, that a few hotheads were causing all the trouble, and also that London had been appeasing the colonists for far too long, ever since repealing the stamp duty in 1766. The king told his prime minister,
"All men seem now to feel the fatal compliance in 1766 has encouraged the Americans annually to increase in their pretensions to that thorough independency which one state has of another, but which is quite subversive of the obedience which a colony owes to its mother country."
And so, in the spring of 1774, the British Parliament passed a bill closing the port of Boston until compensation was paid for the tea. It also replaced Hutchinson with General Thomas Gage as governor of Massachusetts and placed Boston under military rule. Gage assured the king that the colonists
will be lions whilst we are lambs, but if we take the resolute part, they will undoubtedly be very meek.
But in fact, this new legislation, quickly dubbed the Intolerable Acts, united the colonies as never before. Thousands of people sent cash, food and fuel to Boston. George Washington, a landowner in Virginia, wrote to a relative in Yorkshire,
"The cause of Boston, the despotic measures in respect to it, I mean, now is and ever will be considered as the cause of America. Not that we approve their conduct in destroying the tea."
Washington told his brother-in-law,
"The crisis is arrived when we must assert our rights or submit to every imposition that can be heaped upon us, till custom and use will make us as tame and abject slaves as the blacks we rule over with such arbitrary sway."
Today, it's hard to read that last sentence about the slaves without raising an eyebrow. But Washington didn't do irony. His words are a telling reminder of the paradoxes of American liberty.